This is a supplemental recording for Philosophy 205, the second exam study guide, and it's Thursday, May 10th, 2012. So I think I skipped over a few things. I wanted to talk about, explain this, the question and this short paragraph at the top, explain right after who pays taxes in America, who doesn't pay. It's the next paragraph. It starts with the sentence, explain how markets may be described as self-correcting. And I didn't elaborate on that much, but it's this idea that when the price goes up, suppliers make more because it becomes much more lucrative for them to supply whatever the good or service is because they're getting a better price for it. People are encouraged to find new supplies or substitute supplies or to produce more of that thing. If there is a drop in the demand for a good, suppliers will supply less of it because given constant supply, there's a lack of demand, and so supply will drop as well. So everything tends towards equilibrium, and it's all based on price, about what people are willing to pay for. What people are willing to pay for things. And you don't need a central planner fixing prices, fixing wages, setting limits on supply, or trying to curb demand. People figure it out. And out of the system of people with wants and desires and people trying to fulfill those wants and desires, all things tend towards equilibrium. Typically, when you have government intervention in the system, you end up with someone who thinks they see something that needs to be fixed, and instead of letting the market do a natural correction, they do something which has many unintended consequences, almost always bad. What were Karl Marx's criticisms of capitalism? Well, he talked about alienating factory work, the fact that children were being exploited, that people would work long hours for very low wages, and his solution was that the working class rebelled against the capitalist class and seized their factories. So Marx's basic criticism is capitalism is an exploitative system that leads to exploitation of the worker who does all the grunt work and allows the factory owner to just sit back and count the money, and that it results in an unequal distribution of income and poverty and want in a society where that shouldn't be the case, where there's plenty to go around. It's just that it's concentrated in the hands of a few while others go in need. The communist slogan, which describes how economic goods should be distributed according to communism, is from each according to his ability, to each according to his need. That's from each according to his ability, to each according to his need. Class struggle is the struggle for supremacy of the various social classes, and so in the past it was the peasants versus the nobility of the aristocracy. In the time of the Industrial Revolution, this last class struggle is between the proletariat, who are the working class, and the capitalist class, or the factory owners and landowners, in the case of agriculture. So those are the bourgeoisie. So the proletariat are the working class, and the bourgeoisie are the capitalist class, the business owners. Why didn't the worldwide violent revolution of the working class take place as Marx suggested, but only isolated worker revolutions in countries like Russia, China, Cuba, Spain, and South America? Well, Marx did not see the rise of the middle class, and he didn't see that as countries developed, the factories were able to produce goods and services that the factory workers could actually afford, and that as production increased and efficiency increased, standard of living increased. There was also the rise of unions, which gave workers some protections against cases where they might be otherwise be exploited. But by and large, Marx did not see the rise of the middle class through economic development, and through capitalism, that capitalism would lead to this very efficient system of production, mass production of consumer goods, and technological progress, which would transform the lives of people and increase their wealth, increase their purchasing power, give them a wide variety of consumer goods to choose from, allow them to live in bigger houses and have modern conveniences like refrigerators and air conditioning and washing machines, which took the work which took over the work of manual laborers. So your clothes used to have to be washed by hand. And a lot of the things that the working class used to have to do is now done but through automation. And those are all the benefits of the capitalist system, that efficient production, machines producing machines. And as production happens on a wider and wider scale, and capitalism works its magic, then you have more and more goods and services available for people at a lower and lower price. Which, if any of the major goals of the Communist Manifesto, have been implemented in America today. So we saw one of these was a strongly progressive tax system, which we definitely have. And we saw that public schools or government schools is something we have. The abolition of child labor, something that also occurred in the United States. And then some of the other things to various degrees we talked in class about, hefty inheritance taxes and new expatriation taxes for richer Americans. You can leave America, love it or leave it. Well, you can leave it, but you're going to have to pay a hefty sum for the privilege of renouncing your U.S. citizenship now. Of course, the communist countries, they just put up a big fence or shoot you if you try to leave, or make a big wall in the case of like the Berlin Wall. That wall was not to keep people from coming in. It was to keep people from leaving East Berlin, where there was poverty and little freedom because everyone wanted to go to West Germany, which was the side of Europe, which was much more free. So many of the, I talked about centralization of banking and the Federal Reserve System, centralization of communication and transportation, and we have the TSA, we have Amtrak, we have the internet started as sort of a government project, and now we have all these bills that come down the pike which have more and more reason for government control of the internet, to have an off switch, to police the internet for copyright violations. There's retail businesses want to tax the internet. States are hungry for sales tax on the internet. So you get more and more government intervention into communications as well. And then there's monopolies that were granted to the telephone utilities and so lots of intervention of the government in these sort of large scale systems. So even if everything's not run by the government, you do have a massive government intervention in case you're running things like the TSA or air traffic controllers, or Amtrak, and so on. Capitalism and socialism exist in a continuum. That means that you can't really sharply categorize a country and say, well, this country is a socialist country, this is a capitalist country, that you get countries who are more capitalist and less capitalist, more socialist and less socialist. So the more socialist you are, the less capitalist you are, and less capitalist you are, the more socialist you are. But you look at a country like Canada, and it's got, right now, it's got a more free market government with Stephen Harper, and they're sort of, someplace in the middle. You look at a country like Greece, pretty far on the socialist side. You look on Cuba, they're just outright communists. You look at a place like France, well, socialist, not as socialist as Cuba, but not as capitalist as Canada and so on. So they exist in a continuum. It's not like they fit into neat little boxes. And often a country will have elements of both socialism and capitalism. That's why a lot of the socialist countries are called mixed economies. And so I suggest in class, you know, you might look at, say, 50% of your total output of the government is, or sorry, if 50% of the total economic output of your entire country is government spending, then it's safe to say you're a socialist country. In the United States, where you're at like 38.9%, now you're getting close, right? You have a kind of a mixed economy, like many European countries, like Germany or the Netherlands, are very close to the U.S. in per capita GDP going towards government. What does a Russian writer in Pravda have to say about the U.S. economic policy under Obama? Well, basically, Obama is seen as a Marxist who is trying the old, tried and true Soviet idea of Soviet communism. And what the author is saying is that, well, look, we Russians, we wised up. We have embraced capitalism. We have a flat tax. We don't have the government running industries into the ground. And now there's food on the store shelves. People aren't starving to death. We're a big economic superpower now. Whereas under communism, we went broke. And he says, and now Americans are going to do the same. They're going down this failed communist path, and you have the government taking over large industries. And he gives lots of examples of government intervention and control of the economy. And he predicts that the Americans will be beating their chests, crying about their freedom as their company as their country goes into the toilet. And as their freedom is being taken away. So, I mean, the long and short of that is that this writer says, we Russians, we learned our lesson. We're no longer commies. Now the Americans are commies under Obama. And they'll eventually learn their lesson. And it'll be very sad. So laissez-faire capitalism is seen by redundant by defenders of capitalism. It's just seen as what capitalism is, and I suppose not even just by defenders of capitalism, but the word capitalism itself just means it says that the means of production are held in private hands, or in other words, the government does not intervene in the economy. So laissez-faire means let it be. And so laissez-faire capitalism is just pure capitalism, which says the economy and the state are separate. The state does not intervene in the economy. It doesn't try to manage it. It doesn't try to run it. It doesn't try to regulate it. It lets people buy, sell, trade, and invest as they see fit. Crony capitalism, on the other hand, is a system of government favoritism where there's strong intervention to the economy, regulation, taxation, both domestic targeted taxes and tariffs, and you have an army of lobbyists and special interests who decide what gets taxed and what doesn't, who gets a subsidy and who doesn't. And success in business is largely who has pull in Washington. That's not capitalism. That's more like socialism. That's why it should be called crony socialism, or crony fascism, because both fascism and socialism like lots of government intervention in the economy. In socialism, they're running the show. In fascism, they're running the show. It's capitalism that says hands off. It's capitalism that says if a company's going down the tubes, let them fail. Their competitors can pick up the pieces and build something better. You don't prop up a zombie bank or some enterprise which is hemorrhaging red ink. You let them go into bankruptcy. You pay off their creditors, the people that are their debtors, the people they owe money to. And then you allow competitors to buy them up at pennies on the dollar because they're going to run them efficiently because they know how to run an efficient business. Otherwise, they wouldn't have all this capital to be able to buy them up. And typically what you'll get in the situation where you allow a company to go bankrupt, their next largest competitor will just buy them up and a lot of the workers get switched over to the new company dislocation of workers is the wide scale. It doesn't always happen and often is kept at a minimum. You just have a company under new management. How are green energy projects like Solyndra a good example of crony socialism? So Solyndra is this solar panel plant run on government loan guarantees, and it went bust. And basically $500 million, the loan went bad, and $500 million went down the tubes. $500 million, taxpayer money. And it's because, you know, no rational investor would have invested in that company. It was not a good risk. That's why they took government money. And so what? So that's why they needed the government loan guarantees, because no one would fund them, because everyone saw it as a bad risk. But if the government says, we got to get on top of these green energy products, because the government's going to be in the green energy business, and they're looking for, you know, companies, and you get some person who's politically connected to the president or one of someone in his administration some way, or to the party in power, they end up being funded by taxpayers' dollars, and typically they don't do a good job, because if they were competent, they would be able to get a loan on the open market if what they were doing was something that was actually a sustainable business model. They wouldn't have problems getting capital to for their project. What are three ways the government can fund its spending? I did talk about that. Tax, borrow, and inflate. What effect does each have on the economy? So taxes depress the economy. Borrowing means you have interest you have to pay back, and then you have to pay the interest some way, and you have to either borrow money or tax somebody. Again, or inflate the currency, or print money, sometimes it's called. So you just actually create more money out of thin air and pay people back in cheaper dollars. And that's exactly what the Federal Reserve does. The Federal Reserve is a banking system, a federalized banking system, where you have the chairman appointed by the president. They set interest rates and control how much money exists in the economy, and they, in that way, control the economy. So Keynesian economics, I didn't talk a lot about this in class. Steve Forbes talked about it. In Keynesian economics, there's this idea that in a downtime, you want to spend a whole lot of money to give the economy sort of a punch in the arm and get it going again. It's this idea of priming the pump. Sometimes it's called demand push, where you're pushing demand out by putting a bunch of money into the economy. You print a bunch of money, you create a bunch of government make work jobs, even if it's the equivalent of hiring a million people to dig a hole and a million other people to fill up that same hole. And the idea is, just by creating jobs, you're going to have that the effects will reverberate within the economy. And it just, what you end up with when you try to do that is you crowd out investment, which otherwise might go to productive agencies who actually produce a product or service that people want, which have a work towards a technological innovation, or doing something, productive and efficient. Or there's this sort of government program, which is just typically payoffs to connected people, or something that, again, can't get funded in the market, and so they go to the government for cash. And so this $787 billion stimulus package passed by President Obama is a good example of an attempt to jumpstart the economy after the collapse. And what happened? Well, we end up with the $787 billion in debt plus interest. And they've passed a second stimulus package, a smaller one. So you end up with $1 trillion in debt. You got to pay the interest on that. And the economy is not much better than it was before. And you don't have anything to show for it. And a lot of this was bailouts of union pension funds, bailouts for big spending states, and infrastructure projects, very few, at less than 10%. I think less than 8% of the stimulus went towards construction projects like roads and bridges, which is what most people thought it was going towards. Cash for clunkers is a good example of how the Keynesian theory doesn't work. So they were paying people to take in their older automobiles and trade them in for a new car as a way to sort of try to artificially push up demand for new cars. And the idea is you have people buy more cars, and the car automakers, you know, make more cars, and they employ people, and this idea is get the economy going again. Well, what happened is there's a big, when you have a government subsidy, there's this big rush to buy a new car, and so you have people who maybe don't have very much money going out buying cars they can't afford. That's a problem. You have people taking on new debt in a down economy because there's a deal that's too good to pass up. And they're also trading in perfectly efficient, you know, workable, maybe older, but they're you know, cars, your car had to be in good running condition. So and these cars were mashed up for environmental reasons. So you're taking a car that runs just fine, you're taking it into the dealer, they're taking the car and they're destroying it. and then you're getting a new car that you can't afford. And it's a little easier on the gas mileage, maybe save a few bucks. But the problem was you have this buying frenzy, and then afterwards, when they ended the program, guess what happened to auto sales? They plummeted, and they're very, very low, below normal for several months. And then after a while, they evened out to where they were before. So if you compare the peak of frenzied sales with the dramatic drop and lower than normal sales afterwards, guess what? You broke even. But also you destroyed a bunch of useful running cars, and you have consumers buying cars that still, you know, they're taking on a new debt burden through payments. And so apart from any, you know, possible economic environmental benefits, cash for clunkers from an economic standpoint was a bust. And also, guess who's paying subsidies for people to buy brand new cars? You and me. And so that's, again, that's debt that's going to have to be paid for through new taxes, through inflating the currency, making your dollars purchase less, or through a new borrowing. I'm going to ask the definition of economics on the exam. Look it up in Wikipedia if you want. A deficit, that's the total amount of a shortfall each year. So when people talk about the deficit, it's the difference between how much money the government took in and how much spending they did. So the government right now is spending over 40% more than it takes in. The deficits add up to the national debt. So each year there's a shortfall that goes towards it gets added to the number, the total amount that the country owes. So that's a national debt, also called sovereign debt. Don't confuse the deficit, which can be a very, you know, I suppose, relatively small number. It's $1 trillion. So when people talk about the sovereign debt crisis in Europe, they're talking about all these European countries who all owe money to one another, and none of them can pay it back. So you have the more productive countries like Britain, Germany, and France, or I suppose you'd say Germany, France, and Britain in that order. And they're owed money by these even more socialist countries who are on the ropes, the pigs I talked about in class, Portugal, Italy, Greece, and Spain. And all these countries are basically bankrupt, and they're trying to restructure their debt and pay it back, and it's not going so well. And so that's the point of the Clark and Daw video I showed in class about the sovereign debt crisis. And the problem is, eventually, when the principal gets so high, you can't even make the interest payments, let alone touch the principal or the total amount. You're having problems just paying the interest. And so how might this be a harbinger or harbinger of things to come in this country? Well, we've got the same things going on with massive deficit spending. President Obama spent $5 trillion in his first 3 years. It's more than President Bush spent in 8 years. So you have Social Security and Medicare costs going up every year because the population is aging. And so as you you see how, and you have all these pension funds that are underfunded in the unions and the private sector. And so the same thing is happening here as led to the crisis in Greece. It's just going to take a little while longer for it to occur in the U.S., but we're, you know, damn the torpedoes full speed ahead here in America. We're racing towards a Greek-like crisis and default with the levels of spending we're seeing. So I used to say, someday, the United States will owe as much as it takes in a single year, and now that's happened. The current U.S. debt is over $15 trillion. I think it's $15.7 trillion. And that's about the same as our gross domestic product, which is also $15 and some odd trillion. This money's owed to people that bought treasury bills, so they're sort of like stock in the United States, and also foreign countries like China and Japan own a lot of U.S. debt. And that's one of the jokes, you know, on that video I showed where one of the guys says, well, why is the U.S. economy going doing so well? Well, because it's owned by China. And China does own a lot of our debt along with Japan. And you know, this has consequences for trade policy. You can't make a lot of noise about trade policy or pirating of intellectual property when a person is your major debtor nation, or when you're a major debtor nation to this country. And you know, human rights abuses and those things. Politically, it's difficult to make a fuss about these things. Why? Because our economic fate, it rests in the Chinese hands. The Chinese recently have been reducing their U.S. debt exposure and buying gold. In what way might Social Security be described as a Ponzi or pyramid scheme, similar to Bernie Madoff's fraudulent bilking of rich Palm Beach Jewish investors? Well, again, a Ponzi scheme or a pyramid scheme is where there's no underlying investment and you're paying off the old investors with new investors' money. And Social Security does the same thing. There's no retirement fund waiting there for you. It's all you're paying the retirement of seniors who are on Social Security and Medicare right now. And then when you retire, you think somebody else will be funding your retirement. The problem is when Social Security started and Medicare, you had, let's just take Social Security, but Medicare is a similar sort of scheme. So you had 40 workers for every one retiree. Okay, well, you have 40 people working and they're supporting this one person, this one retiree. That's a system that actually might work. But then it went down to 30. And then 20, and then 10, and now there are only 3 workers for every 1 retiree. And then pretty soon it's going to be 2. And so we're getting to the point where it's not really a sustainable system, and so the only thing you do is cut benefits, raise the cap at which you have to pay Social Security, so sort of try to get more money from the top, or go to a private system. And this is what Chile did, and they made their Social Security system solvent by going to a privatized system based on the advice of American economists who couldn't get their own country to listen to them, so they went down to Chile, and it's a big success for a private pension system. So they just gave older workers the chance to get out of the government system and get into a private system, and because the return is so great, they all went to the private system. What happens when people stop buying treasury bonds or worry that they're not going to get their money back? Well, you end up again with the problems with Greece, where interest rates go way up. And right now, interest rates are extremely low. And so the amount of interest we're paying on the debt is only, it's about, 7% of our budget. What happens when those rates go up? Well, it's going to cost billions and billions and billions of dollars more to pay those debts back. And when you're dealing with a total debt of $15 trillion, $20 trillion, $25 trillion, and you're looking at the interest payments on those with an interest rate which isn't, at rock bottom levels, but which might be at more normal levels, then it's just not going to be, you're not going to be able to pay it back. And there's going to be a default. And you're saddling future generations with huge taxes to pay back the debt. Or if there's a default, there's all sorts of international things that can happen. There are people who own treasury bills that are going to lose their life savings and so on. Because of the huge amount of spending done by the Obama administration, and most of which happened when the Democrats controlled the White House and the House and the Senate before the Republicans took back the House. So you had the Democrats running both houses of Congress and having the presidency, and they rammed through these huge spending bills, and that's when most of the debt was incurred. And so because of this, because we've been spending so much, Standard & Poor's downgraded the U.S. credit rating. So we're seen as a bad credit risk. Why? Because we're spending like crazy, deficits as far as the eye can see, no plan for getting this spending under control at all. Or at least no plan that's politically feasible that under the current makeup of Congress has any chance of passing. And certainly not one that's going to get by the president, who keeps on putting forth these $3.8 trillion budgets that are so unrealistic that they get voted down by even his own party. He gets zero votes. He's gotten zero votes for any of the budgets that he's sent off to the Senate for ratification. These are the issues that animate the Tea Party. So the Tea Party started in 2009 when there's a fellow on television named Ray Santilli. He's like a TV financial pundit guy. And he's on the floor of the Chicago Stock Exchange. And he's talking about the president's free spending way, the way that the economy was in the tank, the markets were in the tank, and things were like really bad. And this was like, I think, in February of 2009. And he said, we need a new American Tea Party. And so because of that, you have this grassroots movement. And the issues of the Tea Party are deficits, debt, honest government, anti-corruption, making people adhere to the Constitution and its limited authority. So it's sort of a pro-individual freedom, limited government, low taxes, cut government spending sort of movement. So, broadly characterized as conservative or libertarian, but very populist. So you have people that they're not there on abortion or immigration or those sorts of hot-button social issues, but they're largely coming together on these economic issues. And so these tea parties would happen on April 15th, and they are protests against new taxes coming down the pike and runaway government spending. And now what's happening is the Tea Party's organized, and they've gotten some. There's 47 different Tea Party groups, but there's a few really big ones, and they're getting behind candidates. And there was a guy, Richard Lugar, who's sort of this really sort of moderate Democrat-like Republican, spends lots of money, doesn't even live in his district, seems out of touch, career politician, and they got behind a more populist candidate who is more fiscally conservative, wants to cut government spending, wants to lower taxes and regulation and go back to the Constitution, and this guy defeated Lugar in a landslide. This is in a senator from Indiana. So you have here a very unusual situation of a queer politician being trounced out in a primary by a populist candidate backed by the Tea Party. The Tea Party is not a political party. So it's a grassroots movement. They don't have any central leader, but you're united by issues and ideology. And you know, their constituency is, you know, sort of middle America people, you know, middle class, a lot of retirees with, you know, time on their hands to participate in politics, tend to be, you know, a little older, again, older middle class and sort of middle America people. The Occupy Wall Street, on the other hand, their issues, they have a lot of issues, and it's hard to find a unifying theme, but largely the Occupy Wall Street movement are anti-Wall Street, anti-bank, anti-corporation. They think that corporations hold too much power, that businesses and capitalism exploit people, and so what they want is less capitalism and more government. They want the government to, some of them want to nationalize major industries like the oil industry, which means, you know, take it over, you know, a la Karl Marx, and have the government run it. They want massive regulations on banks and investments and the stock market, even more so than were recently passed by the Democrats and the Dodd-Frank bill, the FinReg or financial regulations bill. They want even more regulations, and they want more heavy taxations on corporate profits, much more than we have now, which is 35%. And they tend to be urban, and they're kind of a mixture of college students, college dropouts, union people. There's a heavy union presence. Sometimes the unions will actually pay people to participate in the protests. Pressure groups. So you get, you know, the usual sort of protest groups like ACORN and the peace movement, I think, has got into the act. And so the Occupy Wall Street movement also tends to be rather young. And what would they like to, you know, do for the country? I mean, their idea is, you know, more government control of business and industry, and control of the economy. Why is price gouging wrong, according to Snyder? So Snyder says price gouging is wrong because it undermines fair access to essential goods. So it undermines fair access to essential goods. And so during a natural disaster like Hurricane Katrina, people who supply goods jack up the price because people are willing to pay it because there's a short supply. And this, he thinks, leads to unfairness in that people can't afford the astronomical prices, and so they're not able to get the things that they have a dire need for in a disaster situation. And so he thinks that should be banned, but otherwise he thinks that you ought to generally allow prices. It's only in these very rare and extreme circumstances of a natural disaster that where people need have can't get the necessities they need, that he thinks that there that ought to be that or that it's wrong, and so he thinks it's it fails to respect persons as persons. And so again, he says that, you know, the profit motive, there's nothing wrong with wanting to make a profit, and there's nothing wrong with capitalism per se. It's just that in a certain respect, it doesn't see the human need and the extraordinary circumstances. It doesn't respect this person's need and their desire to have that need filled. It treats the persons as objects instead of treating persons as persons. Treats them as objects to extort astronomical sums from, you know, take advantage of. So the idea is they take advantage of people without thinking about their feelings or what it does to them to not be able to get food or water or to be able to take care of their children and so on. According to Zwolinski, who writes the pro-price gouging article, he says, look, price gouging and prices generally, they serve a useful function in signaling a scarcity of essential goods, and it causes people to conserve and only buy what they need. So when stores start charging an arm and a leg for things, it stops somebody from going in and buying up all the water because it's only a dollar a gallon or what have you. So if someone goes in and buys up all the bottled water, then there's none left for everyone else. Well, if you jack up the price for those bottles of water instead of from $1 to $10, somebody's not going to go there and buy all the water because they don't have enough money for it. And so people only get enough water, as much water as they need. Zwolinski, his non-worseness claim is that if a person isn't any worse off than if the price gouger hadn't offered the good at all, it can't be immoral for them to offer them at a high price. So I'll say that again. If the person gouged isn't any worse off than if the gouger hadn't offered the good at all, it can't be immoral to offer them at a high price. So the person is willing to pay the high price, and if they're better off even having paid the high price, if it's worth it to them, then you can't say you've done something wrong to that person. And that seems to make sense, that it's not as if you're harming that person. You're actually providing something they want, and they're willing to pay a certain price for. And the other thing is that the price gouging actually attracts people into the area who otherwise wouldn't go because it's not worth their time. It attracts entrepreneurs that want to profit from the situation. They want to profit from the restricted supply. So you actually get, yeah, this is what he talks about when he talks about the price signal. You get new supply coming in. Why? Because people think they're going to make a killing selling bottled water. Can you normally make a killing selling bottled water? Well, not really. You can make some money, but you're not gonna make a killing unless you go in there with a bottle of water to some disaster area. Then you're gonna sell a lot of bottled water, and people are gonna pay a lot more for it, and you're gonna make a lot of money. Well, that leads a lot of water and everything else, batteries and whatever else you might need in a disaster. It leads people to it increases the supply dramatically in a rapid fashion. Let's see. And that's it. Good luck on the exam. Is there anything else I want to throw in here? You should know how much the total national debt is, which is just rounded off to $15 trillion. And I think that's the only real number I'm going to ask for on this exam. Except for maybe the 10th Amendment. You should know what the 10th Amendment is, which is the, sometimes known as the States' Rights Amendment, but it's the amendment which, says that that Congress is restricted to its enumerated powers. That, basically if the power isn't written in the Constitution, that Congress doesn't have it. Good luck on the exam. Next week we'll be talking about feminism, gender equality, and the wage gap, and affirmative action. So look at the handouts in Moodle on the wage gap, and on the story on the majority of women, or the majority of people getting college degrees now being women, and also the affirmative action reading in Poimen, and I'll have a couple more readings on affirmative action. We'll talk about on Thursday of next week. You have until Thursday of next week to take the exam. Close of labs is 7 o'clock Thursday. If you have any questions, feel free to send me a Moodle message.